if you bring your creditor tomatoes from the garden, it never occurs to you that he would want to give something back. He might expect you to do it again, though. But always there is the assumption that the situation is somehow unnatural, because the debt really ought to be paid. This is what makes situations of effectively unpayable debt so difficult and so painful. Since creditor and debtor are ultimately equals, if the debtor cannot do what it takes to restore herself to equality, there is obviously something wrong with her. It must be her fault. This connection becomes clear if we look at the etymology of common words for debt in European languages. Many are synonyms for fault, sin, or guilt. Just as a criminal owes a debt to society, a debtor is always a sort of criminal. In ancient Crete, according to Plutarch, it was the custom for those taking loans to pretend to snatch the money from the lender's purse. Why, he wondered. Probably so that, if they default, they could be charged with violence and punished all the more. This is why, in so many periods of history, insolvent debtors could be jailed, or even, as in early Republican Rome, executed. A debt, then, is just an exchange that hasn't been brought to completion. It follows that debt is strictly a creature of reciprocity and has little to do with other sorts of morality. Communism, with its needs and abilities, hierarchy, with its customs and qualities. True, if we were really determined, we could argue, as some do, that communism is just a condition of permanent mutual indebtedness, or that hierarchy is constructed out of unpayable debts. But isn't this just the same old story, starting from the assumption that all human interactions must be by definition forms of exchange, and then performing whatever mental somersaults are required to prove it? No, all human interactions are not forms of exchange. Only some are. Exchange encourages a particular way of conceiving human relations. This is because exchange implies equality, but it also implies separation. It's precisely when the money changes hands, when the debt is cancelled, that equality is restored, and both parties can walk away having nothing further to do with each other. Debt is what happens in between, when these two parties cannot yet walk away from each other because they're not yet equal. But it is carried out in the shadow of eventual equality, because achieving that equality, however, destroys the very reason for having a relationship. Just about everything interesting happens in between. In fact, just about everything human happens in between. Even if this means that all such human relations bear with them at least a tiny element of criminality, guilt, or shame. For the Tiv women whom I mentioned earlier in the chapter, this wasn't much of a problem. By ensuring that everyone was always slightly in debt to one another, they actually created a human society, if a fragile sort of society, a deliberate web made up of obligations to return 3 eggs or a bag of okra, ties renewed and recreated, as any one of them could be cancelled out at any time. Our own habits of civility are not so very different. Consider the custom in American society of constantly saying please and thank you. To do so is often treated as basic morality. We are constantly chiding children for forgetting to do it, just as the moral guardians of our society, teachers and ministers, for instance, do to everybody else. We often assume that the habit is universal, but as the Inuit hunter made clear, it isn't. Like so many of our everyday courtesies, it's a kind of democratization of what was once a habit of feudal deference, the insistence on treating absolutely everyone the way that one used only to have to treat a lord or similar hierarchical superior. Perhaps this is not so in every case. Imagine we're on a crowded bus looking for a seat. A fellow passenger moves her bag aside to clear one. We smile or nod or make some other little gesture of acknowledgement. Or perhaps we actually say thank you. Such a gesture is simply a recognition of common humanity. We're acknowledging that the woman whose bag had been blocking the seat is not a mere physical obstacle, but a human being, and that we feel a genuine gratitude towards someone we will likely never see again. None of this is generally true when one asks someone at the table to please pass the salt, or when the postman thanks you for signing a delivery. We think of these simultaneously as meaningless formalities, and as the very moral basis of society. Their apparent unimportance can be measured by the fact that almost no one would refuse on principle to say please or thank you in just about any situation, even for those who might find it almost impossible to say I'm sorry or I apologize.
In fact, the English please is short for if you please, if it pleases you to do this. It's the same in most European languages. French, s'il vous plaît, Spanish, por favor. Its literal meaning is, you are under no obligation to do this. Hand me the salt. Not that I'm saying you have to. This isn't true. There is a social obligation, and it'd be almost impossible not to comply. But etiquette largely consists of the exchange of polite fictions. To use less polite language, lies. When you ask someone to pass the salt, you're also giving them an order. By attaching the word please, you're saying that it's not an order, but in fact it is. In English, thank you derives from think. It originally meant, I will remember what you did for me, which is usually not true either. But in other languages, the Portuguese, obrigado, is a good example. The standard term follows the form of the English, much obliged. It actually does mean, I am in your debt. The French merci is even more graphic. It derives from mercy, as in begging for mercy. By saying it, you're symbolically placing yourself in your benefactor's power, since a debtor is, after all, a criminal. Saying you're welcome or it's nothing, French de rien, Spanish de nada, the latter has at least the advantage of being literally true. It's a way of reassuring the one to whom one has passed the salt that you're not actually inscribing a debt in your imaginary moral account book. So is saying, my pleasure. You're saying, no, actually it's a credit, not a debit. You did me a favour, because in asking me to pass the salt, you gave me the opportunity to do something I found rewarding in itself. Decoding the tacit calculus of debt, I owe you one. No, you don't owe me anything. Actually, if anything, it's me who owes it to you. As if inscribing and then scratching off so many infinitesimal entries in an endless ledger makes it easy to understand why this sort of thing is often viewed not as the quintessence of morality, but as the quintessence of middle-class morality. True, by now middle-class sensibilities dominate society, but there are still those who find the practice odd. Those at the very top of society often still feel that deference is owed primarily to hierarchical superiors, and find it slightly idiotic to watch postmen and pastry cooks taking turns pretending to treat each other like little feudal lords. At the other extreme, those who grew up in what in Europe are called popular environments, small towns, poor neighbourhoods, any place where there is still an assumption that people who are not enemies will, ordinarily, take care of one another, will often find it insulting to be constantly told, in effect, that there is some chance they might not do their job as a waiter or taxi driver correctly, or provide house guests with tea. In other words, middle-class etiquette insists that we are all equals, but it does so in a very particular way. On the one hand, it pretends that nobody is giving anybody orders. Think here of the burly security guard at the mall, who appears before someone walking in a restricted area and says, "Can I help you?" On the other, it treats every gesture of what I've been calling baseline communism as if it really were a form of exchange. As a result, like in TIV neighbourhoods, middle-class society has to be endlessly recreated as a kind of constant flickering game of shadows, a criss-crossing of an infinity of momentary debt relations, each one almost instantly cancelled out. All of this is a relatively recent innovation. The habit of always saying please and thank you first began to take hold during the commercial revolution of the 16th and 17th centuries, among those very middle classes who were largely responsible for it. It is the language of bureaus, shops and offices, and over the course of the last 500 years it has spread across the world along with them. It is also merely one token of a much larger philosophy, a set of assumptions of what humans are and what they owe to one another, that have by now become so deeply ingrained that we can't see them. Sometimes, at the very brink of a new historical era, some prescient soul can see the full implications of what is beginning to happen, sometimes in a way that later generations can't. Let me end with a text by such a person. In Paris, Sometime in the 1540s, François Rabelais, lapsed monk, doctor, legal scholar, composed what was to become a famous mock eulogy, which he inserted in the third book of his great Gargantua and Pantagruel, and which came to be known as In Praise of Debt. Rabelais places the encomium in the mouth of one Panurge, a wandering scholar and man of extreme classical erudition, who, he observes, knew 63 ways of making money, the most honourable and the most routine of which was stealing. The good-natured giant, Pantagruel, adopts Panurge and even provides him with a respectable income, but it bothers him that Panurge continues to spend money like water and remains up to his ears in debt. Wouldn't it be better, Pantagruel suggests, to be able to pay his creditors? Panurge responds with horror, God forbid that I should ever be out of debt. Debt is, in fact, the very basis of his philosophy. Quote, always owe somebody something. Then he will be forever praying God to grant you a good, long, and blessed life. Fearing to lose what you owe him, he will always be saying good things about you in every sort of company. He will be constantly acquiring new lenders for you, so that you can borrow to pay him back, filling his ditch with other men's spoil. Unquote. Above all else, they will always be praying that you come into money. It's like those ancient slaves destined to be sacrificed at their master's funerals. When they wished their master long life and good health, they genuinely meant it. What's more, debt can make you into a kind of god, who can make something, money, well-wishing creditors, out of absolutely nothing. Quote, worse still, I give myself to Bonnie St. Bobelin if all my life I have not reckoned debts to be, as they were, a connection and colligation between heaven and earth, uniquely preserving the lineage of man, without which, I say, all human beings would soon perish, and perhaps to be that great world soul which, according to the academics, gives life to all things. That it really is so, evoke tranquilly in your mind the idea and form of a world. Take, if you like, the 30th of the worlds imagined by Metrodorus, in which there were no debtors or lenders at all, a universe sans dette. Amongst the heavenly bodies, there would be no regular course whatsoever. All would be in disarray. Jupiter, reckoning that he owed no debt to Saturn, would dispossess him of his sphere, and with his Homeric chain hold in suspension all the intelligences, gods, heavens, demons, geniuses, heroes, devils, earth, sea, and all the elements, the moon would remain dark and bloody. Why should the sun share his light with her? He is under no obligation. The sun would never shine on the earth. The heavenly bodies would pour no good influences down upon it. Between the elements, there will be no mutual sharing of qualities, no alternation, no transmutation whatsoever. One will not think itself obliged to the other. It has lent it nothing. From earth no longer will water be made, nor water transmuted into air. From air fire will not be made, and fire will not warm the earth. Earth will bring forth nothing but monsters, titans, and giants. The rain will not rain. The light will shed no light. The wind will not blow. There will be no summer, no autumn. Lucifer will tear off his bonds, and sallying forth from the deepest hell with the Furies, the Vengeances, and the Horned Devils, will seek to turf the gods of both the greater and lesser nations out from their nests in the heavens. Unquote. And what's more, if human beings owed nothing to one another, life would be no better than a dogfight, a mere unruly brawl. Quote, amongst human beings, none will save another. It will be no good a man shouting, help, fire, I'm drowning, murder. Nobody will come and help him. Why? Because he's lent nothing, and no one owes him anything. No one has anything to lose by his fire, his shipwreck, his fall, or his death. He's lent nothing, and he would lend nothing either hereafter. In short, faith, hope, and charity would be banished from this world. Unquote. Panurge, a man without family, alone, whose entire calling in life was getting large amounts of money and then spending it, serves as a fitting prophet for the world that was just beginning to emerge. His perspective, of course, is that of a wealthy debtor, not one liable to be trundled off to some pestiferous dungeon for failure to pay. Still, what he is describing is the logical conclusion, the reductio ad absurdum, which Rabelais, as always, lays out with cheerful perversity, of the assumptions about the world as exchange, slumbering behind all our pleasant bourgeois formalities, which Rabelais himself incidentally detested. The book is basically a mixture of classical erudition and dirty jokes. And what he says is true. If we insist on defining all human interactions as matters of people giving one thing for another, then any ongoing human relations can only take the form of debts. Without them, no one would owe anything to anybody. A world without debt would revert to primordial chaos, a war of all against all. No one would feel the slightest responsibility for one another. The simple fact of being human would have no significance. We would all become isolated planets who couldn't even be counted on to maintain our proper orbits. Pantagruel will have nothing of it. His own feelings on the matter, he says, can be summed up with one line from the Apostle Paul. Owe no man anything save mutual love and affection. Then, in an appropriately biblical gesture, he declares, from your past debts I shall free you. What can I do but thank you? Panurge replies.
And that's the end of chapter 5 of David Graeber's Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And we are going to start chapter 6, but before we do, for a change of pace, let's hear 15 minutes of G. Edward Griffin. Now, he was author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, about the creation of the Federal Reserve, so he's studied this fairly comprehensively. And this is 15 minutes on the topic from his reality course on money.
Now, the first draft was called the Aldrich Plan, and it became the proposed Aldrich Bill. This was never voted upon in Congress due to the fact that Senator Aldrich's name was associated with Wall Street, and it became obvious that this was a Wall Street bill. And so eventually, after a great deal of political maneuvering, when it became obvious that the Republican-sponsored Aldrich Bill was not going to pass, there was a quick change of strategy. Democratic Congressman Carter Glass vociferously denounced the Aldrich Bill as a scheme of the big banking interests, and then introduced his own bill for banking reform. Aside from a change in the wording and a slight rearrangement of the sections, there were no significant differences between the two bills. The Glass Bill was nothing but the Aldrich Bill with a new name, a new party label, and a new public image, which of course was most important. Now, there were many small regional bankers who truly opposed this bill because they saw it would cartelize the banking industry and subordinate the smaller banks to the control of Wall Street. But the big banks also publicly opposed the plan, while all the while behind the scenes pouring millions of dollars into propaganda to promote it to the public and to Congress as true reform to stem the power of the big banks. So on the one hand, we had the big, powerful Wall Street banking interests financing the plan and publicly denouncing it. The Federal Reserve Act was passed on December 22, 1913, by an overwhelming majority of both the House and the Senate. America once again had a central bank, privately owned, and it does so to this day. Since 1913, there have been some 200 amendments to the original act. Just as specified by Paul Warburg, one by one, every limitation on the system's power and every safeguard against abuse has been quietly removed. Gold is no longer required as a backing to our currency. The limits on the ratio of pyramiding fiat money on top of debt have been removed altogether. It's even now legal for the Federal Reserve System to create money not only out of the debt of the American government, but out of the debt of every other government in the world as well. A little known fact to know and tell. The creature of Jekyll Island long ago broke out of its restricting eggshell, and it has grown into a monster of such proportions that today it literally holds unlimited power over the economic life or death of the American people. And by and large, the people are not even the slightest aware of that fact. In truth, they do not know, and they do not care. Well, at least, not yet. but they will. And the reason that they will is best illustrated by the next section of this presentation. This is what I call the Great Duck Dinner. When one has control over the availability of credit and the issue of money, one can control the economic activity of the nation quite independently of the natural laws of supply and demand. The cabal often has used this power to artificially create economic booms and busts, which traditionally have been blamed on the free market operation of capitalism. The greatest example of this was the Great Depression of the 1930s. And most history books tell us that the Depression was caused by unbridled capitalism, the free market run amok. Actually, it was just the opposite. A careful reading of the events shows that it was a classic case of the duck dinner mechanism. The Federal Reserve System, almost immediately after it began operations in 1914, started to flood the economy. Well, credit was easy, businesses expanded their operations, people were put to work, which was good, but many of the new ventures were not economically sound and only became possible as a result of an unnaturally easy supply of credit. The ducks were being encouraged to linger around the free grain. The prices people were willing to pay for speculative investments began to rise as easy money was bid against other easy money. Everyone began to acquire stocks and real estate investments on margin, which means that they put down only a small percentage of the purchase price, and in effect, they borrowed the balance from their brokers. With the prices of these shares being forced up by the flood of newly created money, paper fortunes were being made by those who took the wildest chances and plunged deepest into debt. The message was irresistible to the more cautious elements of the population. By 1929, a major segment of the American people had been lured into accepting the principle of wealth through debt. The bubble, of course, had to burst, whether the unenlightened public thought so or not. For several months before the stock market collapse, Warburg, Morgan, and other leading figures on Wall Street had been giving quiet and often subtle warnings to their close associates. When the bottom finally did fall out, virtually none of the international financiers, the monetary scientists, none of these people were caught heavily in the market. Only the ignorant were hurt, which, of course, as always, was about 97% of the population. The assets of many of these people were acquired by those who held cash, unencumbered by debt. By and large, those were the men who were close to the center of power on Wall Street and its subsidiaries, the regional banks of the Federal Reserve System. It was the greatest duck dinner the world had yet seen. Now, one doesn't have to be a professor of economic history to see the many parallels between the period leading up to the crash of 1929 and the present. Once again, we have the Federal Reserve pumping unbelievable amounts of fiat money into the economy. And once again, we see the apparent prosperity and expansion of industry, in all too many cases, far in excess of what the market can long support. We see ups and downs in the credit cycle, but in the long run, an interest rate that isn't much in excess of the inflation rate, which means a true net interest rate that is exceptionally and unnaturally low. Now, those are the similarities. There are differences, of course, and in many ways, the differences are more important than the similarities. First of all, during the expansion of the money supply in the 1920s, the prices of commodities generally remained stable. During the present period, prices have been going up. Now, there's a reason for that. The reason is that the upward pressure on prices caused by the creation of fiat money can be offset by the downward pressure of improved productivity as a result of advancing technology. Now, during the 20s, there was a vast growth in technology and productivity. If there had not been the upward inflationary pressure of fiat money, prices actually would have gone down, resulting in an even greater improvement in the standard of living than was seen at that time. Today, by contrast, we continue to have an advance in technology and productivity, perhaps even at a greater rate than ever before in our history. This, by itself, would tend to cause the prices of products to go down. Now, the reason that they're going up instead is that the rate of money creation is now much greater than during the period leading to the 1929 crash. Instead of merely offsetting the gains of technology and keeping prices level, as it did in 1929, now the flood of money has surpassed the gains in technology and is pushing prices upward. A very important difference between then and now. Another difference. In the period leading to the Great Depression, U.S. currency, Federal Reserve notes, actually was backed by gold. At the time of the crash, those who possessed currency or convertible claims against currency, these people were kings. They possessed real wealth. In fact, as the Depression deepened, their wealth grew in value. Today, however, our currency is backed by absolutely nothing. In times of a collapse, like in 1929, those who hold currency today will hold no wealth at all. It will do them no good to stand in line at the banks in hopes of converting their checkbook deposits into cash, because the cash will be of no more real value than the checks. Those who hold large quantities of checkbook money or currency today will be hurt the most. And a third very important difference between then and now. The primary cause of the crash of 1929 was the fact that an overly high proportion of the total money supply was committed to investments on margin, which of course means investments based upon debt. When the economy eventually contracted to correct for the artificial expansion of the money market, as it always must at some time or another, many people were caught in the debt squeeze and converted into duck dinner, as we have said. That was then. This time around, not just a portion, but the entire money supply is built upon debt. And today, the size of that debt is much greater in proportion to the gross national product. Now, it's true that there isn't quite as much debt margin in the stock market today as in 1929, but there's a far greater debt per capita everywhere else in the economy. There were no such things as credit cards in those days, or any of the other present sophisticated forms of consumer credit, and the massive growth of these mechanisms have far exceeded the relatively crude and limited lines of credit available to the small numbers of people who invested in the stock market and the real estate markets in the 20s. The rubber band has been stretched much further this time around, and the ultimate snapback will certainly be more severe. In 1929, it was an overextended stock market that collapsed and caused panic at the banks. This time, it probably will be the other way around. It likely will be an overextended banking system that will cause panic at the stock market and all the other markets as well. Now let's examine how this situation has come to pass. It's sometimes called the ticking debt bomb. I call it the giant Ponzi scheme.
And that's where we're going to leave J. Edward Griffin's reality course on money, which was made approximately a decade ago, certainly long before the current so-called financial crisis. A helpful reminder that the money system in its present form was a product of the self-interest of a small elite looking to create a system that they could use to extract tribute from everyone else. And now let's return to David Graeber, sharing his insights on the social and anthropological impacts of money systems and their antecedents. Chapter 6: Games with Sex and Death. When we return to an examination of conventional economic history, one thing that jumps out
is how much has been made to disappear. Reducing all human life to exchange means not only shunting aside all other forms of economic experience, hierarchy, communism, but also ensuring that the vast majority of the human race, who are not adult males, and therefore whose day-to-day existence is relatively difficult to reduce to a matter of swapping things in such a way as to seek mutual advantage, melt away into the background. As a result, we end up with a sanitized view of the way actual business is conducted. The tidy world of shops and malls is the quintessential middle-class environment, but at either the top or the bottom of the system, the world of financiers or of gangsters, deals are often made in ways not so completely different from the ways that the Gungwingu or Nambikwara make them, at least in that sex, drugs, music, extravagant displays of food, and the potential for violence do often play parts. Consider the case of Neil Bush, George W.'s brother, who, during divorce proceedings with his wife, admitted to multiple infidelities with women who, he claimed, would mysteriously appear at his hotel room door after important business meetings in Thailand and Hong Kong. "You have to admit, it's pretty remarkable," remarked one of his wife's attorneys, "for a man to go to a hotel room door, open it, and have a woman standing there and have sex with her." "It was very unusual," Bush replied, admitting, however, that this had happened to him on numerous occasions. "Were they prostitutes?" "I don't know." In fact, such things seem almost par for the course when really big money comes into play. In this light, the economist's insistence that economic life begins with barter, the innocent exchange of arrows for teepee frames, with no one in a position to rape, humiliate, or torture anyone else, and that it continues in this way, is touchingly utopian. As a result, though, the histories we tell are full of blank spaces, and the women in them seem to appear out of nowhere, without explanation, much like the Thai women who appeared at Bush's door. Recall the passage cited in Chapter 3 from numismatist Philip Grierson about money in the barbarian law codes. Quote, "Compensation in the Welsh laws is reckoned primarily in cattle, and in the Irish ones in cattle or bondmaids, with considerable use of precious metals in both. In the Germanic codes, it is mainly in precious metal." Unquote. How is it possible to read this passage without immediately stopping at the end of the first line? Bond maids? Doesn't that mean slaves? Yes, it does. In ancient Ireland, female slaves were so plentiful and important that they came to function as currency. How did that happen? And if we're trying to understand the origins of money here, isn't the fact that people are using one another as currency at all interesting or significant? Yet none of the sources on money remark much on it. It would seem that by the time of the law codes, slave girls were not actually traded, but just used as units of account. Still, they must have been traded at some point. Who were they? How were they enslaved? Were they captured in war, sold by their parents, or reduced to slavery through debt? Were they a major trade item? The answer to all these questions would seem to be yes, but it's hard to say more because the history remains largely unwritten. Or let's return to the parable of the ungrateful servant. Since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. How did that happen? Note that we're not even speaking of debt service here. He is already his creditor's servant, but outright slavery. How did a man's wife and children come to be considered no different than his sheep and crockery, as property to be liquidated on the occasion of default? Was it normal for a man in first century Palestine to be able to sell his wife? No, it wasn't. If he didn't own her, why was someone else allowed to sell her if he couldn't pay his debts? The same could be asked the story in Nehemiah. It's hard not to emphasize with the distress of a father watching his daughter taken off by strangers. On the other hand, one might also ask, why weren't they taking him? The daughter hadn't borrowed any money. It's not as if it's ordinary for fathers in traditional societies to be able to sell their children. This is a practice with a very specific history. It appears in the great agrarian civilizations, from Sumer to Rome to China,
right around the time when we also start to see evidence of money, markets, and interest-bearing loans. Later, more gradually, it also appears in those surrounding hinterlands that supplied those civilizations with slaves. What's more, if we examine the historical evidence, there seems to be good reason to believe that the very obsession with patriarchal honor that so defines tradition in the Middle East and Mediterranean world itself arose alongside the father's power to alienate his children as a reaction to what was seen as the moral perils of the market. All of this is treated as somehow outside the bounds of economic history. Excluding all this is deceptive not only because it excludes the main purposes to which money was actually put in the past, but because it doesn't give us a clear vision of the present. After all, who were those Thai women who so mysteriously appeared at Neil Bush's hotel door? Almost certainly, they were children of indebted parents. Likely as not, they were contractual debt peons themselves. Focusing on the sex industry would be deceptive, though. Then, as now, most women in debt bondage spend the majority of their time sewing, preparing soups, and scouring latrines. Even in the Bible, the admonition in the Ten Commandments not to covet thy neighbor's wife clearly referred not to lust in one's heart, adultery had already been covered in Commandment number 7, but to the prospect of taking her as a debt peon. In other words, as a servant to sweep one's yard and hang out the laundry. In most such matters, sexual exploitation was at best incidental, usually illegal, sometimes practiced anyway, symbolically important. Again, once we've removed some of our usual blinders, we can see that matters have changed far less over the course of the last 5,000 years or so than we really like to think. These blinders are all the more ironic when one looks at the anthropological literature on what used to be called primitive money, that is, the sort one encounters in places where there are no states or markets. Whether Iroquois wampum, African cloth money, or Solomon Island feather money, and discovers that such money is used almost exclusively for the kinds of transactions that economists don't like to have to talk about. In fact, the term primitive money is deceptive for this very reason, since it suggests that we're dealing with a crude version of the kind of currencies we use today. But this is precisely what we don't find. Often, such currencies are never used to buy and sell anything at all. Instead, they're used to create, maintain, and otherwise reorganize relations between people. To arrange marriages, establish the paternity of children, head off feuds, console mourners at funerals, seek forgiveness in the case of crimes, negotiate treaties, acquire followers, almost anything but trade in yams, shovels, pigs, or jewelry. Often, these currencies were extremely important, so much so that social life itself might be said to revolve around getting and disposing of the stuff. Clearly, though, they mark a totally different conception of what money, or indeed an economy, is actually about. I've decided, therefore, to refer to them as social currencies, and the economies that employ them as human economies. By this, I mean not that these societies are necessarily in any way more humane, some are quite humane, others extraordinarily brutal, but only that their economic systems primarily concerned not with the accumulation of wealth, but with the creation, destruction, and rearranging of human beings. Historically, commercial economies, market economies, as we now like to call them, are a relative newcomer. For most of human history, human economies predominated. To even begin to write a genuine history of debt, then, we have to start by asking, what sort of debts, what sort of credits and debits, do people accumulate in human economies? And what happens when human economies begin to give way to, or are taken over by, commercial ones? This is another way of asking the question, how do mere obligations turn into debts? But he means not just asking the question in the abstract, but examining the historical record to try to reconstruct what actually did happen. This is what I'll do over the course of the next 2 chapters. First, I'll look at the role of money in human economies, then describe what can happen when human economies are suddenly incorporated into the economic orbits of larger, commercial ones. The African slave trade will serve as a particularly catastrophic case in point. Then, in the next chapter, I'll return to the first emergence of commercial economies in the early civilizations of Europe and the Middle East. Money as inadequate substitute. The most interesting theory of the origin of money is one recently put forward by French economist turned anthropologist named Philippe Rosbabet. While his work is largely unknown in the English-speaking world, it's quite ingenious, and it bears directly on our problem. Rosbabet's argument is that primitive money was not originally a way to pay debts of any sort. It's a way of reorganizing the existence of debts that cannot possibly be paid. His argument is worth considering in detail. In most human economies, money is used first and foremost to arrange marriages. The simplest, and probably the most common way of doing this, was by being presented as what used to be called bride price. A suitor's family would deliver a certain number of dog teeth or cowries or brass rings or whatever is the local social currency to a woman's family, and they would present their daughter as his bride. It's easy to see why this might be interpreted as buying a woman. And many colonial officials in Africa and Oceania in the early part of the 20th century did indeed come to that conclusion. The practice caused something of a scandal, and by 1926, the League of Nations was debating banning this practice as a form of slavery. Anthropologists objected. Really, they explained, this was nothing like the purchase of, say, an ox, let alone a pair of sandals. After all, if you buy an ox, you don't have any responsibilities to the ox. What you're really buying is the right to dispose of the ox in any way that pleases you. Marriage is entirely different, since a husband will normally have just as many responsibilities toward his wife as the wife will have toward him. It's a way of rearranging relations between people. Second of all, if you were really buying a wife, you'd be able to sell her. Finally, the real significance of the payment concerns the status of the woman's children. If he's buying anything, it's the right to call her offspring his own. The anthropologists ended up winning the argument, and bride price was dutifully redubbed bride wealth. But they never really answered the question, what is actually happening here? When a Fijian suitor's family presents a whale tooth to ask for a woman's hand in marriage, is this an advance payment for services the woman will provide in cultivating her future husband's gardens? Or is he purchasing the future fertility of her womb? Or is this a pure formality, the equivalent of the dollar that has to change hands in order to seal a contract? According to Rosbabet, it's none of these. The whale tooth, however valuable, is not a form of payment. It is really an acknowledgement that one is asking for something so uniquely valuable that payment of any sort would be impossible. The only appropriate payment for the gift of a woman is the gift of another woman. In the meantime, all one can do is acknowledge the outstanding debt. There are places where suitors say this quite explicitly. Consider the Tiv of central Nigeria, whom we have already met briefly in the last chapter. Most of our information on the Tiv comes from mid-century, when they were still under British colonial rule. Everyone at that time insisted that a proper marriage should take the form of an exchange of sisters. One man gives his sister in marriage to another, that man marries the sister of his newfound brother-in-law. This is the perfect marriage, because the only thing one can really give in exchange for a woman is another woman. Obviously, even if every family had exactly equal numbers of brothers and sisters, things couldn't always work this neatly. Say, I marry your sister, but you don't want to marry mine, because, say, you don't like her, or because she's only 5 years old. In that case, you become her guardian, which means you can claim the right to dispose of her in marriage to someone else. For instance, someone whose sister you actually do wish to marry. This system quickly grew into a complex system in which most important men became guardians of numerous wards, often scattered over wide areas, They would swap and trade them, and in the process accumulate numerous wives for themselves, while less fortunate men were only able to marry later in life, or not at all. There was one other expedient. The Tiv, at that time, used bundles of brass rods as their most prestigious form of currency. Brass rods were only held by men, and never used to buy things in markets. Markets were dominated by women. Instead, they were exchanged only for things that men considered of higher importance. Cattle, horses, ivory, ritual titles, medical treatment, magical charms. It was possible, as one Tiv ethnographer, Akigasai, explains, to acquire a wife with brass rods, but it required quite a lot of them. You would need to give 2 or 3 bundles of them to her parents to establish yourself as a suitor. Then, when you did finally make off with her, such marriages were always first framed as elopements, another few bundles to assuage her mother when she showed up angrily demanding to know what was going on. This would normally be followed by 5 more to get her guardian to at least temporarily accept the situation, and more still to her parents when she gave birth, if you were to have any chance of their accepting your claims to be the father of her children. That might get the parents off your back, but you'd have to pay off the guardian forever, because you could never really use money to acquire the rights to a woman. Everyone knew that the only thing you can legitimately give in exchange for a woman is another woman. In this case, everyone has to abide by the pretext that a woman will someday be forthcoming. In the meantime, as one ethnographer succinctly puts it, the debt can never be fully paid. According to Rosbave, the Tiv are just making explicit the underlying logic of bride wealth everywhere. The suitor presenting his bride wealth is never paying for a woman, or even for the rights to claim her children. That would imply that brass rods, or whale's teeth, cowrie shells, or even cattle, are somehow equivalent of a human being, which by the logic of a human economy is obviously absurd. Only a human could ever be considered equivalent to another human. All the more so, since in the case of marriage, we're speaking of something even more valuable than one human life. We're speaking of a human life that also has the capacity to generate new lives. Certainly, many of those who pay bride wealth are, like the Tiv, quite explicit about all this. Bride wealth money is presented not to settle a debt, but as a kind of acknowledgement that there exists a debt that cannot be settled by means of money. Often, the two sides will maintain at least the polite fiction that there will, someday, be a recompense in kind, that the suitor's clan will eventually provide one of its own women, perhaps even that very woman's daughter or granddaughter, to marry a man of the wife's natal clan. Or maybe there will be some arrangement about the disposition of her children. Perhaps her clan will get to keep one for itself. The possibilities are endless. Money, then, begins, as Rosbave himself puts it, as a substitute for life. One might call it the recognition of a life debt. This, in turn, explains why it's invariably the exact same kind of money that's used to arrange marriages that is also used to pay Wehrgeld, or blood wealth, as it's sometimes also called, money presented to the family of a murder victim so as to prevent or resolve a blood feud. Here, the sources are even more explicit. On the one hand, one presents whale's teeth or brass rods because the murderer's kin recognize they owe life to the victim's family. On the other, whale teeth or brass rods are in no sense, and can never be, compensation for the loss of a murdered relative. Certainly, no one presenting such compensation would ever be foolish enough to suggest that any amount of money could possibly be the equivalent to the value of someone's father, sister, or child. So, here again, money is first and foremost an acknowledgement that one owes something much more valuable than money. In the case of a blood feud, both parties will also be aware that even a revenge killing, while at least it conforms to the principle of a life for a life, won't really compensate for the victim's grief and pain either. This knowledge allows for some possibility of settling the matter without violence. But even here, there is often a feeling that, as in the case of the marriage, the real solution to the problem is simply being temporarily postponed. An illustration might be helpful. Among the Nuer, there is a special class of priestly figures who specialize in mediating feuds, referred to in the literature as leopard-skin chiefs. If one man murders another, he will immediately seek out one of their homesteads, since such a homestead is treated as an inviolate sanctuary. Even the dead man's family, who will be honor-bound to avenge the murder, will know that they cannot enter it, lest terrible consequences ensue. According to Evans Pritchard's classic account, the chief will immediately start trying to negotiate a settlement between the murderer and victim's families, a delicate business because the victim's family will always first refuse. Quote, "The chief first finds out what cattle the slayer's people possess and what they are prepared to pay in compensation. He then visits the dead man's people and asks them to accept cattle for the life. They usually refuse, for it is a point of honor to be obstinate, but their refusal does not mean that they are unwilling to accept compensation. The chief knows this and insists on their acceptance, even threatening to curse them if they do not give way." Unquote. More distant kin weigh in, reminding everyone of their responsibility to the larger community, of all the trouble that an outstanding feud will cause to innocent relatives, and after a great show of holding out, insisting that it is insulting to suggest that any number of cattle could possibly substitute for the life of a son or a brother, they will usually grudgingly accept. In fact, even once the matter has technically been settled, it really hasn't. It usually takes years to assemble the cattle, and even once they have been paid, the two sides will avoid each other, especially at dances, for in the excitement they engender, merely bumping into a man whose kinsman has been slain may cause a fight to break out, because the offence is never forgotten, and the score must finally be put paid with a life. So, it's much the same as with bride wealth. Money does not wipe out the debt. One life can only be paid for with another. At best, those paying blood wealth, by admitting the existence of the debt and insisting that they wish they could pay it, even though they know this is impossible, can allow the matter to be placed permanently on hold. Halfway around the world, one finds Lewis Henry Morgan describing the elaborate mechanisms set up by the Six Nations of the Iroquois to avoid precisely this state of affairs. In the event one man killed another, quote, "immediately upon the commission of a murder, the affair was taken up by the tribes to which the parties belonged, and strenuous efforts were made to effect a reconciliation, lest private retaliation should lead to disastrous consequences. The first council ascertained whether the offender was willing to confess his crime and to make atonement. If he was, the council immediately sent a belt of white wampum in his name to the other council, which contained a message to that effect. The latter then endeavored to pacify the family of the deceased, to quiet their excitement, and to induce them to accept the wampum as condonation." Unquote. Much as in the case of the Nuer, there were complicated schedules of exactly how many fathoms of wampum were paid over, depending on the status of the victim and the nature of the crime. As with the Nuer too, everyone insisted this was not payment. The value of the wampum in no sense represented the value of the dead man's life. Quote, "The present of white wampum was not in the nature of a compensation for the life of the deceased, but of a regretful confession of the crime, with a petition for forgiveness. It was a peace offering, the acceptance of which was pressed by mutual friends." Unquote. Actually, in many cases, there was also some way to manipulate the system, to turn payments meant to assuage one's rage and grief into ways of creating a new life that would in some sense substitute for that one which was lost. Among the Nuer, 40 cattle were set as the standard fee for blood wealth, but it was also the standard rate of bride wealth. The logic was this: if a man had been murdered before he was able to marry and produce offspring, it's only natural that his spirit would be angry. He had been, effectively, robbed of his eternity. The best solution would be to use the cattle paid in settlement to acquire what was called a ghost wife, a woman who was then formally married to the dead man. In practice, she was usually paired off with one of the victim's brothers, but this was not particularly important. It didn't really matter too much who impregnated her, since he would be in no sense the father of her children. Her children would be considered the children of the victim's ghost, and as a result, any boys among them were seen as having been born with a particular commitment to some day avenge his death. This latter is unusual, but Nuer appears to have been unusually stubborn about feuds. Khosbabe provides examples from other parts of the world that are even more telling. Among North African Bedouins, for instance, it sometimes happened that the only way to settle a feud was for the killer's family to turn over a daughter, who would then marry the victim's next of kin, his brother, say. If she bore him a male child, the boy was given the same name as his dead uncle, and considered to be, at least in the broadest sense, a substitute for him. The Iroquois, who traced descent in the female line, did not trade women in this fashion. However, they had another, more direct approach. If a man died, even of natural causes, his wife's relatives might put his name upon the mat, sending off belts of wampum to commission a war party, which would then raid an enemy village to secure a captive. The captive could either be killed, or, if the clan matrons were in a benevolent mood, and one could never tell, the grief of mourning is tricky, adopted. This was signified by throwing a belt of wampum around his shoulders, whereupon he would be given the name of the deceased, and be considered, from that moment on, married to the victim's wife, the owner of his personal possessions, and in every way, effectively, the exact same person as the dead man used to be. All of this merely serves to underline Khosbabe's basic point, which is that money can be seen in human economies as first and foremost the acknowledgement of the existence of a debt that cannot be paid. In a way, it's all very reminiscent of primordial debt theory. Money emerges from the recognition of an absolute debt to that which has given you life. The difference is that instead of imagining such debts as between an individual and society, or perhaps the cosmos, here they are imagined as a kind of network of dyadic relations. Almost everyone in such societies was in a relation of absolute debt to someone else. It's not that we owe society, if there is any notion of society here, and it's not clear that there is. Society is our debts. Blood debts. Lele. Obviously, this leads us to the same familiar problem. How does a token of recognition that one cannot pay a debt turn into a form of payment by which a debt can be extinguished? If anything, the problem seems even worse than it was before. In fact, it isn't. The African evidence clearly shows how such things can happen, though the answer is a bit unsettling. To demonstrate this, it'll be necessary to look at one or two African societies with a closer focus. I'll start with the Lele, an African people who had, at the time that Mary Douglas studied them in the 1950s, managed to turn the principle of blood debts into the organizing principle of their entire society. And that's where we're going to leave David Graeber for this week. Now, if that seems like a slightly crazy way to organize your society around the system of blood debts, you've got to ask, is that actually any crazier than the system of exponentially increasing debt?
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving.